Y'all good? So I was studying for this, and I knew this was coming up, you know, several weeks ago, and I wasn't planning to go down this route. I was planning to prepare a different message, and I don't know if this one just kind of ended up calling me, or I just kind of somehow I came to this one. But several months ago, a little while back, I did a message titled "Developing a Grateful Heart," and in it, I went through different aspects of a grateful heart, and one of those was praise or worship, and that's kind of what I'm going to get into today. And we're going to see worship as we see it in the showdown on Mount Carmel. Now, maybe in your life, you know, as a believer, there's something that needs energizing. Maybe you really want to feel that touch from God. You know, sometimes life can get stagnant and it can get stale, and you kind of want to feel that, you know, that joyous of your salvation that you had, you know, way back at the beginning. It's like, it's fresh, it's new, and there's a spark, and it kind of has gone dead a little bit, and you want to feel that again. So we're going to open up to 1 Kings 18. And we'll start here in verse 1. And verse 1 is kind of setting up the story of this competition. It's this showdown that we see on Mount Carmel. All right, beginning in verse 1. "And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, Go present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth." So we know here in 1 Kings 18, there has been a drought in the land. It's been 3 years of no rain, 3 years of no crops, 3 years of rationing water. You know, we need rain. We need a downpour. So again, just a little preface to where we're at here in 1 Kings 18. Israel had turned their back on God. Ahab was king, and, you know, most of us, we grew up in church, we know Ahab. We don't even know more about him. We know he was a wicked king. We know he was a bad king. But the people were serving idols, the gods of the people around them, and there was but one voice, and that was Elijah. And if we scroll down to verse 19, Elijah tells Ahab to gather up all his prophets and meet me at Mount Carmel. And so it says there's 450 prophets of the god Baal, and 400 prophets of the goddess Asherah. So it's 850 prophets versus one man of God. And Elijah issues a challenge to the prophets of Baal. He said, "We're going to build two altars. We're going to get two bulls, and you put one bull on your altar. You call to your god, and I'm going to put a bull on my altar. I'm going to call to my god, and we'll see who the true God is." And as you read, it says that from morning until evening, the prophets of Baal are calling on their god, and Elijah is goading them. It says he's mocking them, saying, you know, maybe he's meditating. You know, maybe he's busy. You know, maybe he's on a journey or he's taking a nap, but you know, you need to call louder, try and wake him up. And it says they cried louder and they began to cut themselves, but no matter how much they cried, how much they cut themselves, nothing happened to their altar. Finally, it reaches evening and it's Elijah's turn. And he says, "Lord God, let it be known this day that you are God in heaven and earth." He's saying, "God, in the face of these idolaters, in the face of these false prophets, show who the true God is. Get glory for yourself." And it says, fire fell from heaven. And it didn't just burn the sacrifice. It says it wholly consumed it. The sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the dust, it says it licked up the water that was in the trench around it. And at that point, the people knew, because the fire fell on the mountain. And I think a lot of us want that today. The same way it happened for Elijah, you know, we want to feel and see. You know, we don't want to just go through the motions. You know, I can come to church every Sunday and I can do my daily devotions. I don't want my life to look the same today as it did a year ago, 5 years ago. We don't want to be stagnant. We want fire. We want change. And so the first thing that we see here is we see the climate, and we see that the people of God had become infatuated with the idols of their world. You know, at the start of the journey, God delivered them out of Egypt, but now they're in the Promised Land, and all these gods from the surrounding nations, you know, they've begun to kind of, we'll take that one. We're going to mix and match a little bit. We'll grab this one. We're going to get that one. We'll all kind of bring them together, and they've begun to worship them. If you will, real quick, turn back to Deuteronomy 6. We're going to hop back there just for a second. And in chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, we see that God he's trying to prepare his people for success. And he says, follow my statutes and commandments so that your days may be prolonged. Hear, Israel, and do that it may be well with you and you increase mightily. So he led his people out of Egypt, out of bondage, and he led them into the Promised Land. He can do the same for us, but the world's saying, no. He's trying to take you out of the Promised Land and take you back into bondage. He's trying to take you out of more and into less. We know that the opposite is true, but many people are convinced that God is really holding them back from expressing their true selves, being who they are meant to be. You know, these strictures and these commands, you know, they're weighing me down. This religion that I'm in, it's once I bust free, I can live like I'm meant to live. God does not hold us back from freedom, from success. It says, follow my commandments that it may be well with you, that you may increase mightily, and that your days may be prolonged. But there is a warning that he issues to Israel, and we see it starting in verse 10 there in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Starting in verse 10. So it shall be, when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full, then beware, lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. It's like, come on. Who could forget the Lord? You know, he brought you out of slavery, he brought you into the Promised Land, and then you forget him. And, you know, you think, what's wrong with these people? We continue there in verse 13. He says, you shall fear the Lord your God and serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the people who are all around you. For the Lord your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of the Lord your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth. So God tells them all the things he'll give them. You know, he's going to give them the cities, the houses that they did not build, the wells they didn't dig, vineyards and the olive trees that they didn't plant. And he said, then beware lest you forget me, which will be your downfall, because I'm a jealous God. Glory is rightfully mine. I won't share it with another. I will not share my glory with idols. We know about self-promoters. You know, we know self-aggrandizing politicians and celebrities, high figures in society. But God is also a type of self-promoter. You know, generally we see those as negative, but God is a self-promoter. His creation declares his glory. His word, you know, when we read his word declares his glory. The cross declares his glory. He declares it. The first of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. The second one says, no graven images. Don't serve them. Don't bow down to them, because I'm a jealous God. See, God said, I'm giving you all these things. I'm giving you the cities and the vineyards, the houses, all these things that you didn't build. But here's the thing. Don't mess around with those other gods, those other, those idols. That will be your end. And, you know, we become so concerned, you know, did I cross the line here? Did I say something that I shouldn't have? You know, because that's what God's concerned about. And don't get me wrong, God is concerned about those things. If we read down in Deuteronomy 6, you know, we see that God is concerned about our conduct, about our character, and how we live. But I think more importantly, he is concerned about our worship, because he's not going to share that with another. You know, I thought, no, he's concerned about whether I quit drinking, or whether I listen to that music. Now, I better quit because that's what he really cares about, right? I don't think that's right. I think that's wrong. And just go with me for a little bit. This is what took me a little while when I was studying here, is, and I came to this conclusion on why I think worship is so important. I think we will not change our behaviors for something that we don't deem worthy of changing our behaviors for. We will not change our behaviors for something or someone who we do not deem worthy of changing our behaviors for. Only after I deem that thing worthy, give it worth or value, will I change my behaviors concerning that thing. If I were an atheist, if I were a Buddhist, if I were any other religion, the teachings of Christ, I wouldn't care about them. I wouldn't care about his commandments. I wouldn't care about the statutes that he speaks about, because I don't consider him worthy. I don't consider him a deity. As a Christian, I do consider him worthy. I do consider him not just a deity, I consider him to be the deity. And so, only after I consider him to be of worth do I change my behaviors, do I change my desires, do I change anything in my life. But coming back here, we can turn back to 1 Kings 18, and we see here that the Israelites were infatuated with the idols of their world. And Gabe, you can go ahead and put up that picture, if you would. And back in 1 Kings 18, verse 19, we see that people were worshiping Baal and Asherah, among other gods as well. And a little far, but you can see that. That is a picture of Baal. Now, Baal was the Canaanite god of storm, of rain, of fertility. And this is a 4-foot steel, a 48-inch steel that was recovered in Syria in 1932. And that's a depiction of Baal. And that currently sits in the Louvre in France. And you can see on the, I guess, his upper hand, that is like the storm, the rain, that's like the lightning that he's holding. And then in his other hand, he's holding a spear. The shaft is meant to fertility. He was the god of fertility, but not just of offspring, but also of crops and growth and things like that. Asherah, I don't have a picture of Asherah, but Asherah was the mother goddess, and the Canaanites associated her with sacred trees, or maybe in some of your translation in verse 19 it says the prophets of the groves. Well, those were prophets of Asherah. And throughout the land, at these various religious locations, there would be a sacred tree or a pole standing about like this that was meant to honor the goddess Asherah. And so surely we would never end up worshiping a 48-inch idol, would we? Or a pole carved out of a tree? They did. They became infatuated with the idols of their time. And when they did, God sent a call to them. And the call was the voice of Elijah. We see in verse 22, he says, I only, remain a prophet of the Lord. He was the only one left. But he was willing. And Elijah met Ahab and said, gather your prophets and meet me up at Mount Carmel. And we see what he has to say starting in verse 20 of chapter 18. Reading in verse 20, so Ahab sent for all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. And Elijah came to all the people and said, how long will you falter? Now, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. Does that sound familiar anywhere else in Scripture? It seems to me that it's somewhat similar to the message to the Laodiceans in Revelations, where he says, you know, I'd rather you be hot, or I'd rather you be cold, but because you're lukewarm right here in the middle, I'm going to vomit you. I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. And I've wondered, I don't know if anybody else has, but I've wondered about that. Like, you know, why would God rather have us be cold? Why would he not have us at least be warm? You know, we're at least somewhat in favor of God. And I think it's the same reason that Elijah stood on the mountain and said, let's get it straight today. If you believe that God is God, then follow him. Completely follow him. If you believe Baal is God, then follow him. But let's stop trying to hop between these two opinions. Let's stop riding the fence, so to speak. How many amateur historians, how many fans of history do we have in here? Hands up high. I can't get enough of it. I love it. Growing up, I had many misconceptions about history. And just through studying and learning about it, I've corrected many of those misconceptions. One of which was about the about this own country, about our revolution. Growing up, I was like, oh, it's the redcoats, it's the British versus the Americans, it's the colonists, you know, the little guys over here. Come to find out, through just researching and learning, it's a civil war. It was a civil war before our civil war. And that was one misconception. The other one was I thought, you know, all the cool places you can go see all the monuments and things like that, they're all up in the north. And I realized that even in the south, there's places that you can go, but I came to understand, especially in the south, that lines, you had to pick a side. Historians say that at no point was the revolution, we understand popular perception. At no point was there greater than 50% popular, were more than 50% of the people in favor of the revolution. It was always a minority movement. And I did not know that. I thought it was the Americans versus the British. And learning, there were severe consequences for you if you picked the wrong side, or if the wrong side was dominant in your area at that time. But you had to pick a side. There were repercussions for you if you tried to ride the fence. And Elijah's saying it's the same thing. You know, it's time to make a decision. If God's God, follow him. If your idol is God, follow your idol. If you're going to be cold, be cold. If you're going to be hot, be hot. But let's stop trying to hold on to God with this hand and then drag our idol along the back with this hand. And that call is still here. He's saying, you know, listen, if Jesus is alive from the dead, follow him. If your idol is going to get you what you want, follow your idol. But let's make a decision. Stop trying to waver back and forth, ride the fence. Waver back and forth between these opinions. So I guess the question remains, have you seen enough? Have you experienced enough to know where your feet are? Your feet on the cornerstone of Jesus. You know, Satan can't take you off that cornerstone, but he can bring a storm that makes you doubt whether that stone's going to hold, or he can attempt to lure you off with glamour, fame, wealth. Can you say, you know, I'm standing on this rock and it's enough? God is enough. So the call came, and then came the clarification. What's the clarification? The clarification is God showing up and saying, you know, is it God? Is it me? Or is it Baal? We're about to find out. Here comes some fire, and now we know. God can provide the same clarification for us. When we're doubting, you know, is God real? Is he powerful? Can he come through in my situation? Will he come through? He can clarify those same questions in our heart as he did, 3,000? I don't even know the exact how many years ago it was, but 3,500 years ago on Mount Carmel? he can clarify those questions. There's some other things he can clarify. Why did the fire fall on Elijah's sacrifice and not on Baal's sacrifice? Or the prophets of Baal's sacrifice? And I mean, obviously, it's because we serve a true God, not a false God. But look down at verse 38 there in 1 Kings 18. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. So Elijah drenched the sacrifice and the wood with water, and he did it again. Then it says he did it again, so that water ran all around the altar and filled up the trench with water. And Elijah prayed, God, let it be known that you are God in Israel. And at that point, fire fell from heaven. Just taking just a brief step back, do we understand the situation that Elijah was in? Elijah was a wanted man. It says earlier in verse 10 that there was no nation or kingdom where Ahab had not sent someone to hunt and track down Elijah. So in a way, the sacrifice was not the altar or the bull, the wood, the stones, even the water. Water's we're in a drought. Water is a valuable commodity. It is literally our lifeblood almost. But the faith. Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Stepping back for our historians again real quick, has anybody heard of the term crossing the Rubicon? The term crossing the Rubicon means crossing a point of no return. Once I cross this line, there's no going back. I have pushed my chips all in. I either win or lose on this hand. Elijah had crossed the Rubicon. Standing on Mount Carmel, only one of two things was going to happen. Either God would send fire from heaven, or Elijah was a dead man walking. There was no backup plan for Elijah. There was no plan B. His faith is saying, God, all my hope, my whole being is right here. It's all in you. That's an extravagant sacrifice. And so it says, a fire fell from heaven, and everyone fell on their face and said, "Now he's God, the Lord, he is God." For the prophets of Baal, it says that it was too late. They were executed, it says. For Ahab, Elijah told him, you better hop in your chariot and get back to Jezreel before you get stuck, because rain's coming. A downpour is coming. Now, it didn't look like rain. There weren't storm clouds overhead. But if we look back to verse 1, God said to Elijah, present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain. Now, I don't see rain. It doesn't look like rain. God said it's going to rain, so you best believe that rain's coming. And it says Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel and told his servant to look out to the sea, to look out towards the Mediterranean. And it says that he came back, don't see anything. He says, go again. Comes back, still nothing. Go again. Came back, still nothing. He says seven times he sent his servant before he finally came back and said, there's a cloud way, way out there, and about the size of my fist, rising up out of the Mediterranean, and it says that Elijah here saying, that's it. Rain's coming. This drought, it's coming. It's coming to an end. We better get back to town, because a storm's coming. A gully washer's coming. This place is dry. We're up on the mountain. We're going to get stuck up here if we don't hurry back. And it says the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah. And it says he ran ahead of Ahab back to Jezreel. Not with a chariot. Not with a horse. It says he ran back ahead. Every time I read that, I had to think of Elijah's poor servant just watching Ahab, watching Elijah just tear off, and he's just trudging through the rain. And I just crack up at that every time. But the scripture says he girded up his loins and he ran past Ahab back to Jezreel in the power of the Holy Spirit. Don't you want some kind of new power? That seems fun. Don't you want your drought broken? How long has it been since you felt rain in your heart or fire in your life. I don't think it's about trying harder. It's about who you choose to worship. I'm not going to get fire in my life while I have Baal in my back pocket. And I've lived that way for a while. Who can identify with that? Am I the only one who can identify with that? I know we live in mostly a digital media age now, but back in the days of exclusively physical media, was there ever a time that you came back from a service, or we just came through a revival meeting, was there ever a time that you came back from a revival meeting and something's just tugging on your heart, and you know what you're thinking about? You go home and maybe you grab that CD or magazine or DVD, whatever it is, and you know, you're feeling inspired or you're feeling convicted, and you toss it in the trash or you toss it in the fire, you tear it up, get rid of it. A month later, that feeling has worn off, and we're back to just everyday life, and you know, you're really missing that song. That's a catchy song. You're really missing that movie or show or whatever you were watching. And now you're back at the store, it's like, I really need those things back. I'm missing this soundtrack, I'm missing this music, or whatever it is. And I'm not saying that we need to go back to trying to you know, white knuckle, I'm going to try harder mentality. But surely there's got to be something today that you can toss in the trash, throw in the fire. You know, we just came through a revival meeting, and we talked about wanting to experience revival in this country, both personally and as a nation. I haven't thought a ton about revival. I don't think the formula is incredibly complex. There's no void, either in this country or sometimes even in our hearts, for God to fill. Our time is all spent up, our mental space, our mental energy, our day, it's filled up. And God gets a piece of it. He might get 15 minutes here and there. God gets a piece of it, but there's nowhere for him to come into for us to experience revival. And I think that only once we release, you know, all these things that we cling to, all these things that we put our hope in, that we think that we can't live without, only once we release them can God come in and fill that space and we experience revival. I think God's weary of a generation of people saying, we want revival. And he's saying, get Baal out of your pocket, and I'll give you revival. That's all I had. This was a message for me as much as it is for anybody else. And it wasn't where I was intending to go, but it's just kind of where God led me, and I hope it spoke to you guys as much as it did to me. Still only about 11:30. We'll just go ahead and wrap it up. In fact, we'll just go ahead and dismiss now, unless there's anything else, Gene, that we've got. Let's just stand for prayer, and we'll just dismiss with prayer. Andrew, would you mind dismissing us with prayer?